wonderful place. I'll be around through Wednesday night, just before the U2 concert, and look forward to talking to many of you in the interim. So what I want to talk to you about is a particular astrophysical event known as a gamma ray burst, which I'll explain in a second. And this really is a remarkable story that connects the three disparate things I show on the bottom here. Connects the nuclear weapons, the origin of the elements in nature, and our search for gravitational waves. And it's really the connection between these three very different things that I hope to get across. Now, this is, I'll provide a little bit of the astronomical observational context. This will mostly be about the theory of these events. But I know that a lot of this physics, a lot of the background may be stuff that many of you aren't familiar with, so I hope you will interrupt me at any point if you have questions about background or anything like that. Certainly feel free to do so. So this story, and I should say, this is what I'm going to describe to you, is really kind of an overview of a field that's taken 30 years to get to the point where it is now, 35 years. But in particular, I'm going to highlight work that we've been doing at Berkeley for the past 5 years with my student Brian Metzger, who's now at Princeton, and then three postdocs at Berkeley. So this story starts with the launch by the US Department of Defense of the Vela satellites in the 1960s, which were intended to look for violations of the nuclear test ban treaty. So the US didn't trust Russia to not blow up bombs in the Earth's atmosphere. And so at the same time that the nuclear test ban treaty was signed, the US Department of Defense created a whole class of satellites to go up and actually look for evidence of atmospheric nuclear explosions. So these were telescopes that were equipped with things like X-ray detectors, gamma ray detectors, neutron detectors, to look for the electromagnetic or particle, in the case of neutron, signatures of a nuclear explosion in the Earth's atmosphere. And thankfully, I think for all of us, they didn't find any. But they did find, as it turned out, a class of astrophysical phenomena that produced something with characteristics similar to what they were looking for. So they found a class of cosmic explosions that manifest primarily in the gamma rays. And so the first example of what they found is shown here. This is literally the first detection. This was an event that happened in 1967, wasn't discovered actually until quite a bit later, published in 1973, very different from the current time from discovery to publish that we have today. This was actually classified for a while, so it had to go through a whole declassification before the results actually came out in FJ letters. So what this is just as the name gamma ray burst should convey, this is a flash of gamma rays, in this case, a flash of gamma rays lasting maybe 5 or 6 seconds. These are MeV photons or so, maybe, as we'll see later, actually, these events go from tens of keV up to many GeV photons. And this is the basic phenomena that we're going to be talking about today is this. It's an astrophysical transient, so it's a one-off event. These are not repeating phenomena. People have looked for this, but basically these don't repeat. So one place on the sky, one time, you get this flash of gamma rays. And from about 1973 for 20 years or something, we didn't actually know a lot more about these events than this. And the reason for that is simple. It's that gamma ray telescopes, gamma ray photons, are very, very hard to localize. So imagine trying to create a mirror, right, that can localize a gamma ray photon. That's a pretty difficult task. And so what the gamma ray telescopes gave you is that somewhere on the sky, about yay big, on the sky, there was a flash of gamma ray. And that doesn't do you much good if you want to localize, did it come from that galaxy or that galaxy, because the localization of the gamma rays was simply insufficient to give us additional information about what these events were. And so really, the really dramatic progress, in some sense, in this field came almost 30 years after the original discovery. And that was when there were finally detections of these events, not at gamma ray wavelengths, but in other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. So in 1997, the first what are now called afterglows were detected. These were actually, since this is an institute for theoretical physics, it's good to point out these were actually predicted theoretically before they were detected by Martin Rees and Peter Mazaros, among others. So what these are is basically just a longer wavelength, longer timescale counterpart. So you look at roughly the place on the sky where this flash of gamma rays came, and what you see is at the same position, you see a fading source of optical photons, or in this case, this is X-ray flux as a function of time. You see a source that of X-ray photons that fades by 6 or 7 orders of magnitude on a day time scale. And it was the ability to localize where on the sky, and once you knew where on the sky, you could know where along the line of sight, you could get accurate distances to these objects by finding what galaxies they're in, et cetera. And once one knew distances, one could really know the basic energetics of the phenomena under study. In fact, for decades, it was completely unclear whether these flashes of gamma rays were events in our own galaxy or events at the most distant reaches of the universe. And we know it's really the latter now. But that confirmation required this detection at other wavelengths, which allowed us to pin down where they were actually happening, both on the sky and in the third dimension in redshift or along the line of sight. Okay, so to do complete injustice to my observational colleagues who study these events, this is kind of a one-slide basic summary of the basics of the phenomena that we're talking about. So these are flashes of gamma rays, which if you look at where they are on the sky, they're basically distributed isotropically on the sky. And this, to many, Bodon Pachinski and others, this was a big clue that they were not in our own galaxy. They didn't show any of the classic asymmetry of galactic sources, but instead, even before this direct detection of distances, this suggested to many people that they were at cosmological distances, which we indeed now know is the case. So gamma ray bursts are sources isotropic on the sky. They range from relatively nearby us in the universe to the most distant objects that we know of in the universe. They come actually, and this will be important a little bit later, they come in two varieties, what are called in the kind of classic, not very inventive astronomical lingo. They're known as long and short duration gamma ray bursts. And that just refers literally to the length of time over which the gamma rays are emitted. So, and the numbers are, you know, roughly half and half, maybe not quite, but roughly half of the events are of this longer 100-second variety, minute variety, and half are a fraction of a second. At least temporarily for this fraction of a second or day time scale, these are the brightest electromagnetic events we know of in the universe. And that is true in the gamma rays, it is true in the X-rays, and it is true in the optical. So in fact, at almost all wavelengths, these are the brightest electromagnetic sources that we know of in the universe. They're just transient, so they may be the brightest optical source, but that will only last for a day or something like that. So the energetics involved are quite impressive. They're a significant fraction of the rest mass energy of the sun comes out in the form of photons, mostly in the gamma ray band, but at other wavelengths as well. And the energies actually span a pretty wide range from maybe a millionth of a solar mass up to a solar mass of energy. And that energy scale is a big clue as to what we're talking about. In terms of comparisons to other kinds of astrophysical transients that you may have heard of, there are objects called supernovae, which are exploding stars. Some supernovae are the objects that were used to first determine the acceleration of the universe by using distances to a certain class of supernovae. These gamma ray bursts are significantly more rare than supernovae, about 1,000 times rarer. So the rough number is that these occur once every 100,000 years in a galaxy like our own. Okay, so that's the kind of basic summary of the observational phenomena. So as I already emphasized, these really are the brightest electromagnetic sources. And because of that, these are now the most distant objects that we've detected in the universe. If you exclude the detection of the cosmic microwave background at a redshift of 1,000 or so, A gamma ray burst is now the single most distant source that we've detected in the universe. This is just this year. A gamma ray burst was detected at a redshift of 8.3, which is about 5% of the current age of the universe, or just 600 million mega years or so after the Big Bang. And so because these objects are so bright, one of the reasons that there's a particular interest in them is that they serve as a unique signpost of, as we'll see, the formation of stars in the early universe. When structure first started forming in the universe, it started by forming stars, which then built, kind of came together to form galaxies like our own. And these gamma ray bursts really do serve as a signpost to the first stars that were formed in the universe because they're so extraordinarily bright. So on the theoretical side, so turning now really to more of our theoretical understanding, which is what I'm going to focus largely on. The central theoretical problem about gamma ray bursts comes from the enormous energy they release above the rest mass energy of the electron, 511 keV. And the reason this is a problem, or was considered a problem originally, is that these objects, if you look at one of these light curves, right, so this is 10 seconds, but they go up and down on a really short time scale, on millisecond time scales. So if you use standard causality arguments to say, I have an object of a given size, and it varies on a certain time scale, it can only be a certain size given the time scale over which it's varying, then these objects have to be light milliseconds across because of how rapidly they vary. And if you take the energetics, okay, and the size scales, what you work out quickly is that they're incredibly opaque to photon pair production. So photons plus photons go to E plus E minus pairs. E plus E minus pairs go back to photons. And that leads rapidly to a thermalization. So these should be beautiful black bodies because they're so incredibly opaque. And they're not. This is a spectrum taken. This is a recent gamma ray burst observed with the Fermi Gamma Ray Observatory. NASA's now the kind of newest and best gamma ray observatory that's doing a lot of interesting science, including in this area. And this is basically a power law from 10 keV up to tens of GeV. So it's not a black body spectrum. There's no evidence that these objects have thermalized. And what that means, it means that these 10 GeV photons had to be able to escape from the central source without pair producing and degrading to form thermal photons. And the only way to do that, given the distances, the energy scales, et cetera, is for these objects to be moving at us at Lorentz factors of 100 or even 1,000 in some cases. What that does, that bulk relativistic motion of the emitting material towards us, is it decreases the photon energies in the rest frame, and it increases the size scales by Lorentz contraction in the rest frame. The size scales are bigger than what we see of in our frame. And so if the source of the emitting photons is moving at Lorentz factors of 100 or 1,000 to us, then they become optically thin, they become thin to these GeV photons, and one can understand the power law rather than thermal nature of the gamma ray emission. This argument is so strong that it was actually originally used by many people to say that these events could not be cosmological. They could not be at great distances, because if they were at great distances, then they would have to have thermal spectrum. And that's wrong, as happens actually many times in the history of astrophysics. You can evade these simple arguments through special relativity, through motion at nearly the speed of light towards us. And in this case, these are actually among the most relativistic sources we know of. The material is moving again at Lorentz factors of 100 to 1,000. So this is actually a rather remarkable set of observational requirements then that have to be met to explain what we see. You need a source that somehow emits up to a rest mass energy worth of energy on a time scale of a second, and it does so almost entirely in the form of energy with no rest mass, so that the material is moving at bulk Lorentz factors of 100 to 1,000. And these are incredibly stringent requirements. They almost immediately indicate that the source of emission has to have something to do with neutron stars or black holes. Neutron stars or black holes are the only way we know of to get this energy scale, this time scale, and at least potentially incredibly highly relativistic motion. So this pointed from the get-go to some kind of event related to compact objects. And in fact, we now think that there are two independent astrophysical sources that give rise to gamma ray bursts, one associated with these long events and one associated with these short events. So this distinction in the gamma rays between long and short, you know, it seems kind of minor, it actually turns out to be rather important in terms of the astrophysical sources giving rise to them. And so to kind of give away the end result, because it'll help in terms of shaping where we go from now, these longer gamma ray bursts are, we now know, associated with the collapse of an explosion of massive stars at the ends of their lives, probably stars that weigh 40 or 100 times the mass of our sun. At the end of their life, they collapse, explode, and give rise to these long gamma ray bursts. And I'll explain both observationally and theoretically how we think this happens. On the other hand, these short events we actually know definitively only in the past couple of years. We know definitively are not associated with the explosion of a massive star at the end of its life. Instead, they have to be associated with something else. This is pretty definitively established. The astrophysical source giving rise to the short gamma ray bursts is a little bit less clear at this point, but almost all the signals point to the mergers of compact objects, either two neutron stars, a neutron star and a black hole, or maybe even a white dwarf and a white dwarf. And so these short duration gamma ray bursts are really fundamentally different. They're not from the collapse of a massive star, rather they're from the collision of two neutron stars or a neutron star and a black hole. And I'll talk really primarily about these short bursts in what follows, but I'll start by just giving a little bit of the story of these longer bursts associated with massive stars, the death of massive stars. Okay. So any questions up till now? Yep. So the emission at other wavelengths, we believe, so this literally is an explosion of material going out. We think the longer wavelength emission comes when that shell of material blown away collides into surrounding stuff in the galaxy. You kind of pile material up, heat it up, and produce radiation. And you can explain the long and the short afterglows in the same basic theoretical framework. However, these afterglows are significantly fainter on average, it looks like. And we think that's because, for reasons I'll get to, they're coming in a lower density region. There's less stuff around them. And I can explain why that is a little later. Is there another? Definitely not. Right. So let me hold off. I'll come back to that. That's a very good question.
You have black hole mergers?
You want to tell us, Louis, what happens when you have black hole mergers? So you get a great gravitational wave signal. You most certainly do not get any interesting. Well, let me back. If it's just black hole with no matter, you're not going to get an electromagnetic signature. So we haven't seen it yet. Hopefully, LIGO, some other gravitational wave observatory will see this. There are possibilities of interesting electromagnetic signatures of black hole mergers if there's some matter orbiting around the black holes as they collide. So that's an interesting possibility. So I did actually, I forgot to mention, I did want to just mention one thing for this audience. This is kind of a neat point. So these gamma ray bursts arise from, you know, tens of gigalight years away, right? The most distant objects in the universe, and the GeV and the 10GeV photon arrive within a second of each other. And so these objects now provide the tightest constraints on violations of Lorentz invariance or violations on the how the speed of propagation of a photon depends on its energy. And so there's actually a lot of interest in using these to constrain quantum gravity models that might predict a deviation of the a dependence of the photon speed on the energy of the photon. So there's actually a science paper just this year by the Fermi team on just this point. Okay, so, all right, so back to how we think these events actually arise. So I'm going to talk a little bit first about these long duration gamma ray bursts, the ones associated with the death of massive stars, and then talk about these shorter events. So how do we know that these long gamma ray bursts are associated with the death of massive stars? Well, the argument's actually pretty simple observationally. It just took a long time to get there. So you look on the sky at the position where this flash of gamma rays came from, and you see, as I already said, you see this fading afterglow of emission. And then at that same position, as the gamma ray burst fades away on kind of weak time scales, you suddenly see the telltale signature of the explosion of a massive star. So that's a source that rises and fades on kind of weak time scales, not 100 second time scales. And it has very this is a flux as a function of wavelength. It has very characteristic spectral features, signatures of particular atoms in the exploding star. And so this fading of the gamma ray burst and the appearance of what's called a supernova, which is the signature of the exploding massive star, was really the telltale signature associating these gamma ray bursts with the explosions of massive stars. In some ways, it's actually very surprising for reasons I'll get to in just a second. But this is the observational argument that at least some stars, when they die, produce a huge amount of energy in material moving at Lorentz factors of 1,000. Most stars, when they die, don't do this because the gamma ray burst rate is a tiny fraction of the rate of exploding stars. So this is a rare phenomena for exploding stars.
The opening angle for the GeV is small?
No, this is corrected actually for opening angle. This number is, yeah, so I'll come back to that in just a second. Okay. So to give some theoretical context for how we think this happens, let me just quickly review for you the story of how stars explode, which we don't actually know. So I'll review the story, even though we don't really know it. So the story is, right, at the end of the life of a massive star, you've fused all the way up to iron in the core of a star. Fusion above iron doesn't give off any energy. And so thermonuclear fusion is no longer capable of supplying heat to maintain high pressures, which balance gravity. In addition, for massive stars, the core of the star is more massive than the Chandrasekhar mass, so degeneracy pressure can't support the star. So it has no source of pressure support. Thermal pressure is gone, degeneracy pressure is gone, the star collapses. It collapses on about a second time scale, then it hits nuclear densities. When it hits nuclear densities, the nuclei actually don't want to be close to each other at sufficiently high density, so you get repulsion. And so the collapse comes rapidly to a halt when the density of the star is equal to the density of an atomic nucleus, about 10 to the 15 grams per cubic centimeter. And so that is basically the formation of a neutron star. And then something happens on about a second time scale that we don't understand very well that leads to an outward explosion of the outer parts of the star. So you form at the center a neutron star, and that neutron star deposits enough energy into its surroundings to blow up the star. But that explosion, which is a supernova explosion, is, by the scales we're talking about, a pretty wimpy explosion. It's 10,000 kilometers a second, not 0.999 C. So this is a normal stellar explosion. It is a roughly spherically symmetric explosion. Most of the material moving at, 10,000 kilometers a second. It's actually a decent amount of energy. It's about 10 minus 3 m sun c squared in kinetic energy of the ejected material. But it's a completely different velocity scale, right? This is V 0.03 c instead of gamma of 1,000. So what we think is that in a rare fraction of massive stars, this picture of how stars explode, this roughly spherically symmetric picture, has to be augmented by something that's very non-spherically symmetric. It has to be augmented by an additional energy source that can drive this very relativistic explosion. And that energy source is fundamentally, well, it's gravity, but after that, it's really its rotation. We think that a rare fraction of massive stars are rotating so fast that when they collapse, they have this huge energy reservoir in rotation. And that is either, and we actually don't know which it is, it's either the rotational energy of a newly formed neutron star, or it's that material is rotating so rapidly that it cannot all collapse onto the neutron star, the black hole formed at the center of the star. Instead, it hangs up in an accretion disk. Then the material spirals on to the central object in this disk, releasing its gravitational potential energy. Yep. That's a second or less. So that's actually pretty fast. So the collapse time of the star is initially of the core of the star is typically about a second or maybe even a tenth of a second. And material pretty quickly becomes important. So the energy scales to remember are that if I have a neutron star that's rotating with a period of a millisecond, so it rotates 1,000 times a second, then the rotational energy of that neutron star is about 1% of the mass of the sun times c squared. That's the energy scale we're talking about. And if that neutron star has a magnetic field of 10 to the 15 Gauss, which is similar to magnetic fields that have been measured on neutron stars, then what happens is that this rapidly rotating neutron star drives out along its magnetic field lines. It drives a relativistic outflow, most of the energy in Poynting flux. And all that rotational energy of the neutron star is lost to this outflow on a time scale of 100 or 1,000 seconds, which is exactly in the ballpark of what we need. Okay. The other possibility, which is illustrated in this numerical simulation by John Hawley here, is that we may form a rotationally supported disk, actually either onto a neutron star or a black hole. And if you accrete matter onto a neutron star or a black hole, you release energy, gravitational potential energy, at a rate which is about a tenth of mc squared. So in fact, in practice, accretion of energy onto a neutron star or black hole is the most efficient source of energy we know of in astrophysics. It's much more efficient than nuclear fusion and more efficient, in fact, than rotation. Which of these happens in these long duration bursts is actually not entirely clear. So the question is, what happens if one of these goes off now, not isolated, as is shown here, but what if I put a rapidly rotating, strongly magnetized neutron star or a disk of material accreting onto a neutron star or black hole? What if I put that at the center of a collapsing star? By this I really mean that you don't need ever material. Material can always be pressure supported. It doesn't have to be hung up centrifugally. So by this I really just mean it's the rotational energy of the star, not the disk. That's the distinction, right? So in some sense, this takes less angular momentum to form than this. Because for this I need to hang up material well off the surface. And it may well be that both of these are happening. That actually seems rather natural. You have a range of rotation rates which give rise to a range of events. So here's what we think happens if we put one of these inside a massive star. So this is actually a numerical simulation that we've done of putting a rotating magnetized neutron star at the center of a star that is collapsing at the end of its life. This neutron star drives this magnetized outflow into the surroundings. This movie is about 3 seconds long, and you're seeing color. So this is the central part by the neutron star. And way out here, what will be purple in a frame, this goes. So this is now the surface of the star. So what happens is this outflow, this magnetized outflow, is not spherically symmetric. The magnetic field in rotation breaks spherical symmetry. The outflow is driven primarily along the rotation axis of the star. And this is actually a key part of the story of how we produce these events with huge amounts of energy, but very, very little mass, right? Because if you think about it, trying to get all of this energy out in the form of almost pure energy, no rest mass, a massive star is a really bad place to do that, right? A massive star has 100 solar masses of material out here, but to produce one of these gamma ray bursts, I need less than 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4 solar masses of material. So I somehow have to get the energy out without interacting with the mass. And you do that through going out along the rotation axis. And this is actually, this calculation starts from the neutron star surface and goes to the surface of the star. So it's a relatively first principles calculation of what happens. And so the idea, to come back to a couple of the questions that have been asked, is that if we're looking here, the relativistic motion of this material, we're looking along the axis of the motion of the material, that's when we see a gamma ray burst, and then as it fades away, we see a supernovae. On the other hand, if we're looking over here, then this event is beamed away from us. We never see the gamma ray burst. All we see is the supernova, the more spherically symmetric explosion, not the highly anisotropic explosion. And so the question was asked, well, if this is the picture, then shouldn't I see some of these events off axis? And the answer is absolutely. And just 3 weeks ago or a month ago, the first such event was announced, where people think they've actually seen an explosion that did produce relativistic material, but we happen to be looking over here, so we didn't get the full brunt of the relativistic explosion. And in fact, one of the major goals of the upcoming generation of astrophysical searches for transient objects is to see more and more of these off-axis events, which won't show up in the gamma rays as much as they'll show up in the radio and the optical and electromagnetic spectrum like that.
In redshift and length of burst.
Right, so that's a great question. So people have looked for that. You'd expect if you have statistically the same events at every redshift, then there would be some correlation between.
Earth would live much shorter time. So how do you expect to have 100 solar mass,
yes,
redshift 8.3?
No, but the lifetime of a 100 solar mass star is about 3 million years. So it's had plenty of time to form and die by 600 million years after the Big Bang. So I think that's not. There are that we see more massive stars formed in the past, but we see plenty of them forming today. And at least broadly speaking, these gamma ray bursts trace the history of how stars formed in the universe, which is what you'd expect. They're tracing the history of star formation. Yes. What there's not a particular correlation of is literally redshift and time dilation, which you might expect. And that's probably just because the statistics aren't good enough. Okay. So this is the basic picture then of how we get one of these gamma ray bursts inside a collapsing massive star. And notice that the fact that the relativistic material is not isotropic reduces the energy requirement. So the maximum energy that's needed is not a full m sun c squared. It's more like the percent m sun c squared for the most energetic events. And that rate I quoted you of 1 every 1,000 exploding stars already takes into account the change in due to the finite solid m. Okay. Any additional questions about this? No idea. Why 1 in 1,000? Nobody has a clue. And the question really is, why do some stars end up rotating really fast when they're about to explode and some don't? We think that's the basic question. And our understanding of the rotational history of stars, how their rotation evolves in their lifetime, is pretty crude. So this is a really difficult problem on which there's not a very good theoretical understanding. It could have something to do with being in a close binary, which spins you up due to tides. It locks you to rotation equal to the rate of rotation of the orbit. It could have something to do with that. Other ideas are it has something to do with metallicity, so how much metals, how many heavy elements are around. Less heavy elements might be more conducive to this, but we really don't know. This is a big problem. Right.
So rapidly rotating neutron star can be formed because you have the whole star rotating.
Correct. So actually, if you fall in conserving angular momentum, right, the rotational barrier is actually less worse when it's at large distances. So it's not a problem of it breaking up at large distances. Right, that's not the... Yeah, you had to have a rapidly rotating star to start, and how we got that is not clear. We can talk about this more afterward. I think the problem is actually the other way around. If you take the sun when it formed, you would conclude that everything should form a really, really rapidly rotating neutron star. And the problem is that stars don't conserve angular momentum. They have ways of getting rid of angular momentum through outflows, which allows them to rotate slowly. And that process is just not very well understood.
But then it would lose all its heavy mass.
Maybe. Yeah, so these are some of the big questions that people are worried about, right? All right. So I want to move on and talk now about the shorter events, these short duration gamma ray bursts, which in the gamma rays look pretty similar. They're just shorter. But otherwise, their spectra are a little bit different. They're slightly higher energy gamma rays, but they're pretty similar. But what we know now, really only in the past few years, is that unambiguously, these short duration gamma ray bursts are produced by something fundamentally different from the longer kink. And the way we know that is the same argument. You look at the location where the gamma ray burst occurred, and there is no supernova. And there's no sign, in many cases, of ongoing formation of stars. So this is one example. The gamma ray burst went off somewhere in this circle. This is a galaxy with old stars, with no current star formation. So somehow, we're getting a solar mass energy worth of material at Lorentz factors of 100 to 1,000, but without the collapse of a massive star, something fundamentally different. And the best guess, as I already said, is this comes from the mergers of compact objects, from either a neutron star and a neutron star, maybe a neutron star and a black hole, maybe even a white dwarf and a white dwarf. Although I think neutron star, black hole is the most likely. So with apologies to Louis, this is a simulation by somebody else's group of what this merger looks like. So you shred apart the neutron stars, but you leave behind a newly formed black hole, maybe actually a very massive neutron star in some cases, surrounded by a disk of material. And then it's the same old story. So this produces a black hole surrounded by a disk of material. That disk of material accretes, producing outflows that produce the gamma ray bursts. So it's a similar story, just the way we got to the black hole surrounded by the disk of material is different. We don't get it through the collapse of a massive star, we do it through the collision of two neutron stars. And the reason, the argument for the characteristic time scale is actually rather nice, and people noticed this decades ago. If you take a disk of material, say, 10 Schwarzschild radii off the surface of a black hole, and you ask, how long does it take that material through viscous processes to spiral onto the black hole, lose its angular momentum, and fall in, that turns out to be about a tenth of a second to a second. Precisely the duration of these gamma ray bursts. And so this was used for a long time to argue for these events being associated with short periods.
So the simulation on the left, is it a relativistic simulation?
No, this is not a full relativity. Okay. So just to remind you, mergers of compact objects are not something that theorists make up, although they certainly have. We actually know this will happen. We know the rate, not horribly, okay? And the reason we know this is we know three neutron star systems in our galaxy that are emitting gravitational waves and that will merge within a Hubble time. This is what Joe Taylor and Russell Hulse got the Nobel Prize for in physics for the detection of the first of these systems. There are now three of them. By astrophysical standards, three events is very good. You can calculate a rate from three events, suffering from only modest squared event statistics. And the rate is, from these three events, you get that something like once every 10 to 100,000 years, there should be a neutron star merger in our galaxy. This is, given the uncertainties associated with beaming, right, what is the solid angle of these GRBs? This is in the same ballpark as the rate of short GRBs, to kind of a factor of 10, I would say. And so that's encouraging for this association. These events are, of course, extraordinarily interesting because neutron star, and neutron star black hole mergers are the primary astrophysical target for ground-based gravitational wave experiments like LIGO, Virgo. This is what they are hoping to find, is neutron star black hole mergers. And so if this hypothesis associating compact object mergers with short GRBs is right, then there should be an association between gravitational wave sources and electromagnetic sources. And that connection is actually one of the really interesting areas of research right now in this field. So to kind of transition to one of the other topics I wanted to touch on, I wanted to mention one of the really interesting puzzles that has arisen in the last few years associated with these gamma ray bursts that we think should be associated with neutron star black hole mergers. And the puzzle is this. I already told you that the time scale for this material to fall into the black hole is a fraction of a second, which is in beautiful agreement with the time scale of the gamma ray pulse. And that turns out to be not entirely right, some interesting fraction of the time. So between a quarter and a third of the time, these so-called short events actually have a rather long time scale tail of gamma ray emission, which looks, for all the world, like it's a continuation of whatever happened in the first second. So there's a short spike, and then you see this continued gamma ray emission on longer time scales. Hundreds of seconds here. In this time it's actually X-rays. This is somewhat longer time scales. And these are, in some cases, the energy out here can be 10 or 100 times the energy in this initial spike. And so this is a very interesting problem. How does this event, with the natural time scale of milliseconds, which is the orbital period around the surface of a neutron star, or maybe seconds, the time scale to fall into the object from tens of neutron star black hole radii, how does that event produce all of this energy on 10, 100, maybe even 1,000 second time scales? And this is I would say the answer is not entirely clear at this point. This could mean maybe these events are actually something different. Maybe they're not neutron star mergers. Maybe they are. So to quantify a little bit more why this is a puzzle, I want to tell you a little bit more about what happens to this torus of material after it's formed around the neutron star, the black hole. So you have the merger. 10 milliseconds go by. You form your new black hole surrounded by material, maybe a thousandth of a solar mass of material, out at 100 kilometers. And what that does is illustrated here in this one-dimensional movie. So what this movie shows is basically where is the mass as a function of radius and as a function of time. So what happens is that the process of matter falling onto a central object is generally one in which total angular momentum is conserved. If there's no large-scale torque on the system, then total angular momentum has to be conserved. So the way that you get matter to go in is you redistribute angular momentum. You push some of the stuff out to let the rest of it go in. And that's what this movie illustrates. That as the mass goes in, accreting onto the central object, the rest of it has to spread out in time. And so what you might think, and what we actually hoped when we started doing these calculations, what we actually hoped is that maybe just the extension of this spreading disk to 100 seconds, maybe that can explain this, all of this interesting activity on long time scales. But alas, that is not the case. Yep. So this is a one-dimensional model. It's an alpha disk, for since you know this stuff and worked on it in the old days. So this is this has a lot of the microphysics, right? No, this is a model that includes, so just to give you a sense of numbers, the typical temperatures are in MeV densities, or near nuclear densities, because we're around a neutron star or a black hole, so 10 to the 12 grams per cubic centimeter. The material actually loses energy primarily by radiating neutrinos. And so those are included. So you actually calculate the thermodynamics of the disk, evolve the temperature, the density, et cetera. The simplification is that it's one-dimensional and that the treatment of angular momentum redistribution is a little bit ad hoc. And so we're actually working on trying to do better stuff now. Okay. So this looks like it's just, in fact, for those who are mathematical physicists, you can describe this by a beautiful self-similar solution that describes the spreading disk to arbitrarily late times. And it looks like there should be a lot of energy left at late times. As matter goes in, the disk moves to larger radii where the time scales are longer. So it takes longer for things to happen at large radii. But actually, this process blows itself apart after about a second. And the reason is, for physics, it's actually quite analogous to what happens in the Big Bang. So here's the picture of what happened. So initially, as the disk is spreading out, it's radiating energy away primarily by these electron capture reactions. So you get electron capture on protons. It's mostly free nuclei. You get electron captures on protons, creates neutrinos. Those neutrinos escape easily. Unlike photons, any photons which are created can't escape. And so they're stuck there. But the neutrinos escape, taking energy away. And what that does is it means that this disk of material is kept very bound to the central object because you're radiating all this energy away. But as the disk expands to large radii, it cools. The density goes down and the temperature goes down. These reactions become very inefficient at low temperatures. So at some point, the disk of material is no longer able to lose energy to radiating neutrinos. And at that point, it becomes very prone to being disrupted because the material is very weakly bound to the central object. All it takes is a little extra energy and it'll become unbound. And what happens is once the temperature goes below half an MeV, just like in the Big Bang, the free nucleons now recombine to form heavy nuclei. So you start fusing to form helium and heavier elements. And so after about a second, this spreading disk starts to form helium, and that releases enough energy to blow the disk entirely apart. Now, there's a difference relative to the Big Bang that I'll get to, which is that this material is very neutron-rich, rather than the Big Bang, which was actually very proton-rich, which is a very, very important difference. But broadly speaking, there's actually similar physics. This very hot thermal plasma expanding starts to recombine to form heavy nuclei. In this case, that recombination to form heavy nuclei is very important. It energetically unbinds all of the remaining mass, about a fraction of a solar mass. And that material is quite neutron-rich. It's maybe 65% neutrons, 35% electrons and protons when it recombines. So what does this do? Well, one thing it does is it means that at late times, there's simply not enough energy available from accretion to explain all of this late-time emission seen from short gamma ray bursts. And this is illustrated here in some simple calculations, one that does not include the effect of outflows, which actually shows a huge amount of energy still being available at 100 seconds. This is, at every time, this says, what is the energy liberated by accretion at that time? Okay. And this is large compared to what you need to explain the observations. But when you take into account that most of the material is unbound, in fact, at 100 seconds, there's far insufficient energy available to explain the late-time activity from short GRBs. So this is actually a very interesting problem now. It's how do you get all of this action on 100-second timescales given this source that really only lives for about a second? And the best guess, I'll tell you, and there are some interesting problems with this, the best guess right now you can see in this movie. Notice that as the neutron stars are being disrupted, you start to fling material off in tidal streams. So as the neutron stars are being disrupted, you actually fling material off onto relatively weakly bound orbits. And those, in principle, can come back at late times and explain some of what we see. So this is the best idea going right now. But what's pretty clear is that because of this transition to heavy nuclei, the initial material can't do the job. All right. It's neutron-rich because it's degenerate. So under these conditions, this is actually a great, you know, statistical mechanics problem. You take these two reactions and you just balance them, and under degenerate conditions, what's favored is a neutron-rich composition. It's basically the same reason that the neutron star material is primarily neutrons, not that. Yeah, it's because you're at such high density. So even though it's an MeV, it's sufficiently dense that you're still degenerate. Yep. Well, So this is, if you just take the kind of output of Louis' neutron star mergers, which gives you a hundredth of a solar mass at 100 kilometers, that gives you densities such that it's degenerate. So it's actually, I think that's reasonably well established. Okay, so what happens to this material? So now we're blowing away some interesting amount of mass of mostly neutron-rich material. What does this become? Well, this is where the connection to the periodic table that I mentioned at the beginning comes in. So this is a plot of the standard distribution of elements in the solar system. This is a log of the abundance of elements as a function of atomic mass in the solar system from observations of the sun and meteorites and all kinds of different data. This is really a beautiful compilation of observations. And one of the great triumphs, of course, of astrophysics in the 20th century was that we broadly understand where this comes from through a combination of the Big Bang, which gave us the hydrogen and the helium, and then stars, which give us pretty much everything else. So in particular, the nuclei that you end up with, okay, if you go through some period of nucleosynthesis, depends on what you start with. If the nucleosynthesis happens rapidly, so there's no time for beta decays and weak interactions, then it matters what electron fraction you start with. In the Big Bang, you start proton-rich. That's why you end up with hydrogen and helium. In stellar explosions, you start from material that mostly has equal numbers of neutrons and protons. You start with helium, carbon, oxygen, whatever. That nucleosynthesis gives you stuff with mostly equal numbers of neutrons and protons, stuff like iron and nickel. But now we're starting from material that's very neutron-rich. And so we produce neutron-rich nuclei. And so this outflowing material is likely to produce many of these very neutron-rich heavy elements, things like gold and selenium and various things like that. And the numbers are actually really interesting. There's about, this is kind of an amazingly small number given the mass of our galaxy, right, which is, you know, a trillion solar masses or something like that. There's only a few thousand solar masses in all of these neutron-rich elements in our galaxy. So if you take a neutron star-neutron star merger every 10 or 100,000 years, if each of those spews out a hundredth or a thousandth of a solar mass of neutron-rich material, given the uncertainties at present, the numbers work out pretty well, that these could be an interesting source of the neutron-rich nuclei in nature. Okay. So where does this leave us? Well, I hope this gives you a sense of some of the interest and excitement in this field, not only connecting a lot of interesting astrophysics having to do with how stars form and evolve, having to do with how binary systems evolve to form neutron stars and black holes, but there's also a lot of extremely interesting connections to fundamental physics. Gamma ray bursts are, in many ways, one of the most promising probes we have of the very high redshift universe, because they're the brightest electromagnetic sources we know of in the universe. They can give us information about sources beyond where we can see galaxies or even accreting supermassive black holes. In addition, I didn't really go into this, but it turns out that gamma ray bursts are one of the most promising astrophysical sources for very high energy neutrinos, the kinds of things that Ice Cube is looking for. This is through processes like photopion production in this relativistic expanding ejecta. And then perhaps the most interesting connection, I think, is that gamma ray burst sources are really the best candidates for detecting gravitational waves in the next decade. Either most probably through neutron star, neutron star, neutron star black hole mergers, but also possibly these very rapidly rotating stars, when they collapse, they can be very asymmetric. And what you need to produce gravity waves is something that's very non-spherically symmetric. And so it could even be a rare, very rapidly rotating star. I think it's more likely to be neutron star mergers. And this is going to be extraordinarily interesting for a variety of reasons. So this problem of gamma ray bursts is going to be interesting not only because of the advances we'll have in theory and on the electromagnetic side, but also because of these new probes into these events that'll come in by neutrinos and gravitational waves. And we'll learn a lot about general relativity, the equation of state of nuclear matter, probably about the origin of these gamma ray bursts, whether our theories are right, do we detect gravitational waves or not, and as I hope I convinced you, quite possibly about the origin of many of the most neutron-rich elements in nature. Now, a lot of this science, we would actually like to detect not just the gravitational waves. Of course, if LIGO gives us that, we'll take it, right? But then we'll get greedy. We'll like to have an electromagnetic counterpart to that gravitational wave source. And this is actually a little tricky. This is the last thing I want to mention, is that if you go through the numbers of where LIGO can detect and how many events they'll be able to detect and what the beaming angle is, the odds are pretty bad that the gamma ray jet is going to be pointing towards us from an event that we can see gravity waves from. And vice versa, for an event that is pointing towards us, it is too far away for LIGO to see. So we are not going to pair up the gamma ray burst, which is how this thing started, with the gravitational wave source. We need some other more isotropic source of radiation. What is that? Well, this is something a lot of people are thinking about, and I'll give you one possible answer. One possible answer is what happens to all this stuff that gets ejected out? Well, you create all these neutron-rich elements. You actually probably create a little bit of nickel along the way. Nickel is radioactive. Some of these neutron-rich elements you create are actually unstable to fission. What is that going to do? As this ejecta expands out, it cools adiabatically, so it becomes really hard to see. But now, if I can reheat it by some nuclear process, fission, radioactive decay, something like that, then I'll create an electromagnetic source. And this is one thing we've been calculating, is that there's actually predicted, and this actually goes back to work that Bodum Puchinsky did, that there should be a new kind of stellar explosion, a new kind of optical transient, not gamma ray now, that shows up due to radioactive heating of this neutron-rich ejecta expanding out. And it's this kind of thing, not the gamma rays, that's going to serve as the signpost connecting our understanding of the gravitational wave events to our understanding of the electromagnetic events. And so I think this is going to be an extremely exciting next decade in this area. So thanks very much, and I'll be happy to answer any additional questions.
Questions. So there was a recent press release about a gamma ray burst that was supposedly localized somewhere in Andromeda that would have been close enough to like detect it.
Yes. Right. So that's correct. There was a gamma ray burst which went off very near the constellation M31 Andromeda, our nearby galaxy, which statistically is pretty unlikely that some random event at very high redshift should go off very near Andromeda. And in fact, in some sense, this is, you know, one of LIGO's first major science results was to show that that could not have been a neutron star merger, because LIGO would have detected the gravitational waves from something in Andromeda. So what is that? So there's two possibilities. One is that it's just further away and it's a chance superposition. Like this is a hard game. You know, the statistics of what is the probability that something happened to be near something else is a little tricky. The other possibility, which may actually be more likely, is that I didn't talk about this, is that there is actually yet another kind of object that produces a flash of gamma rays like this. That is highly magnetized neutron stars of the kind I talked about to spin down to produce these cosmologically distant long duration gamma ray bursts. Those strongly magnetized neutron stars undergo what are basically solar flares. You have a release of energy on the surface of the star that produces a flash of gamma rays. And we know this because these happen in our galaxy and we see them. These are called magnetars. These neutron stars are actually the most strongly magnetized objects in the universe. These are the neutron stars with 10 to the 15, 3 by 10 to the 15 gas magnetic field. So those events are actually intrinsically much less energetic, right? We see them in our galaxy, and they kind of look like these gamma ray bursts that are coming from the very distant universe. So intrinsically, they're much less energetic. So this event in M31 could very well have been one of these flares from a very strongly magnetized neutron star.
What's the spectrum of it? Energy spectrum is very different.
Right. So that's one of the distinguishing these. These flares from strongly magnetized neutron stars tend to be more thermal looking. And this event didn't particularly look thermal. So in that sense, that's a bit of a problem. So it could be something further away. It could be a flare from one of these strongly magnetized neutron stars.
You said that flares are going to be much less energetic.
But in M31, it's sufficiently close that it's fine. Given the energy scale for flares in our galaxy, if there were one a little bit more energetic, then we would see it in M31. It's the nearest nearby galaxy. So that's fine energy-wise. So there is actually, this is a whole other interesting story about this field of gamma ray bursts, these strongly magnetized neutron stars, which were also predicted theoretically by Chris Thompson, who's at CETA in Toronto. They predicted the existence of these strongly magnetized neutron stars. In fact, partially to explain cosmological gamma rays, and that was subsequently confirmed. Yep.
Yeah, kind of specific at night, but I guess I'm wondering, so you're seeing strongly magnetized objects.
Yep.
So where is the radio from all of this? Are you, and is there a possibility for detection?
Right. So the problem initially with the, so I didn't go into what actually produces the gamma ray emission, what physical process produces the gamma ray. And we think it's either synchrotron emission or inverse Compton upscattering of synchrotron photons. Basically, any time you have a high energy source in astrophysics, you say synchrotron or inverse Compton. That's usually a good answer. And in fact, in this case, those are, we don't know which, actually, the models are, it's hard to pin this down given the information we have, but it's one or the other. So your first guess when you hear synchrotron emission is probably radio, because synchrotron emission produces the radio emission in our galaxy, or it's one of the most dominant sources of radio emission in the universe. In this environment, the magnetic fields are so strong, and the material is so relativistic, right? So remember, the frequency of synchrotron emission scales like the Lorentz factor of the particle squared times the magnetic field strength. So if I up those, I can get that to be in the gamma ray delta radio. That's what happens here. And at low frequencies, it's self-absorbed. So it becomes a black body. And so the spectrum drops like a rock. So you wouldn't expect to see, basically, the synchrotron extension into the radio. That's woefully thin. There, you only see that at very late time. So the radio afterglow is this material as it expands out. The magnetic field decreases, and so the emission, that's basically why the emission moves to longer and longer wavelengths with time, is because the critical the frequency of synchrotron emission is moving to longer and longer wavelengths, as you expect.
So I guess what I was wondering is why we're seeing, is it just a matter of energy that, say, for example, if you look at active galactic nuclei, they're also extremely powerful engines.
Correct.
But you do see radio
coming
off of
Yeah, so that is that's really a spatial and energy scale. I mean, it's the same physical process, but if you just work out the magnetic field strengths and the Lorentz factors of the electrons in the environment around supermassive black holes, it gives you radio kind of gigahertz emission. And in this environment, it's GeV emission, NeV emission. And so it's just the numbers, there's no, it's the energy densities are so much higher.
And they're much bigger.
The active galactic nuclei are, well, the horizon of a supermassive black hole is 10 to 13 centimeters. It's actually not all that different. So it's the energy density that's really huge.
So I have a question.
Yep.
So just having a lot of energy released in the disk due to nucleosynthesis, that doesn't guarantee that the disk is unbound. Because, I mean, some stuff may be unbound, but some other stuff may remain behind.
Yes.
And what kind of calculation have you done?
Right. So, no, that's a very good question. So we've just done some simple arguments to try to estimate potentially how much remains bound. But you're absolutely right. It's possible that what happens is you start to have this nucleosynthesis is you unbind a lot of it, but maybe you leave 10% behind. I don't think so, because there's this relentless expansion which is driving you to consistently fuse to heavier and heavier elements, releasing energy which can unbind you. So I think the sign of this spreading disk is that it always wants to unbind itself. And it will get rid of most of the material, but we really have to do multidimensional calculations, I think, to see that for sure. Because you're absolutely right. It's possible that it could just unbind some fraction.
And does the disk remain thin?
No. As it expands, it initially it loses all this energy by neutrinos, and then it's relatively thin. But as it goes on, as the temperature drops, it can't radiate energy by neutrinos very effectively, and then it gets much, much, much thicker. And that's actually why it gets easier to blow apart, as it's already getting puffier and hotter, okay, and then it becomes easier to blow apart.
So if synchrotron radiation is all or part of the story, does that mean we have a coherent source of gamma rays?
No, so this is, it's still an incoherent source. I mean, the synchrotron process in this case is an incoherent. It doesn't have to be a coherent process. Yeah. So this, there's no, I mean, there are in other astrophysical environments evidence for coherent processes, you know, which some, yeah, anyway, there are evidence for coherent processes where it originally looked like it might have been synchrotron. Here, everything looks like synchrotron. Could be coherent, but it looks like synchrotron. So the, yeah.
So I can see with mergers why it's a sort of all or nothing thing, or you're maybe just picking up all of them. With supernovae, I'm still puzzled. I mean, is the sense that if you increased your gamma ray sensitivity, you would find all supernovae, all massive stars,
no,
supernovae had some small burst associated?
That's a great question. So there's been some really, really beautiful observational work done on that by Alicia Soderberg, who's now a professor at Harvard, and Sri Kulkarni at Caltech. So what they did is they did the kind of obvious thing. Don't look for gamma ray bursts and look if they have a supernovae. Look for supernovae and look if they have any evidence for relativistic material. And the way to do that is what you have to worry about is all this relativistic beaming stuff. So what they did is they said, forget about the gamma rays, the x-rays, the optical. Let's go to the radio. The radios produce when this material that was moving at Lorentz factors of 1,000, when it's run into so much stuff that it actually slows down, and there's not much beaming anymore. And what they showed is if you take a sample of nearby supernovae and you ask, what is their radio flux compared to events that have these relativistic explosions, they showed that about, I think it's now 99% of supernovae have radio fluxes that are orders of magnitude less than these events. So it really is not a continuous distribution. There are the things that produce a good fraction of all of their energy in Lorentz factor of 1,000 material, and then there are those that produce most of their energy in 10,000 kilometers a second, and there's probably some bridge between, but it's not a particularly smooth distribution. So why that is, you know, this might suggest something like binaries, that there's some unique form of binary system where the stars get spun up by the fact that they orbit so close to a companion, which gives them a lot of angular momentum, which makes them collapse to do something like what I just draw. But that's a big clue as to there really are, it really does look like there's not, for instance, just some continuous distribution of angular momentum, because you'd expect a more continuous distribution.
You mentioned at the beginning that optical transients associated with gamma ray bursts had been predicted before they were detected. How do you predict something like that, knowing nothing about gamma ray bursts?
So there was a jump when I went from 1973 to 1998. I think there were already with what was called the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory. So this plot. This plot on the upper right showing that the gamma ray bursts were isotropic. This on the sky, this convinced a lot of people, not everyone, in fact, maybe not even the majority, but it did convince a lot of people that they had to be at cosmological distances. Once you knew they were at cosmological distances, you knew they had to be expanding relativistically, because the only way, that's basically this argument, okay, once they're that energetic, they have to be expanding relativistically. Once you know that, you know any explosion that goes off, you know, anywhere in a galaxy is eventually going to run into stuff and slow down. When it slows down, it's going to emit a longer wavelength. So that was the chain of reasoning that led people like Martin Rees, Peter Mazarez, to make this prediction of longer wavelength association. And in fact, the particular prediction due to supernovae, I think, is astonishing. This prediction that they should be associated with supernovae is really astonishing, because the whole problem in explaining how do you get one of these gamma ray bursts is how do you get so much energy out with so little mass? So why would you ever want to invoke this happening at the center of a star with all that material around you? And so this prediction was actually made by Stan Woolsey, who argued that you could understand these long duration gamma ray bursts as being from the collapse of a massive star. He didn't really have a great story about how the energy got out without the mass, but a variety of features of the events suggested to him that they could be associated with
I mean, it's perhaps worth remembering that other people were also predicting different things that didn't happen.
Yeah, that's right. No, sure. So a fair point is that the famous quip is that for a long time there were far more theoretical models than there were photons detected in gamma ray bursts. Each of these GV photons packs a wallet. So there were tons of ideas out there. 99% of them turned out to be wrong. Nonetheless, given the it's nonetheless impressive that the broad features appear to have all been correctly predicted in some form or another.
Okay, I think let's thank Elliot again.